dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is on Welcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On August 1, 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. Iraq accused Kuwait of drilling at an angle to capture oil that was actually under Iraq. President George Bush, GW's daddy, was determined to go to war with Iraq, stubbornly refusing calls from the international community for a negotiated solution to the Iraqi-Kuwaiti dispute. Kuwait is a small, extremely rich feudal monarchy whose ruling family had hundreds of millions of petrodollars invested in American banks. The situation was presented to the American people as a war to, quote, defend our way of life against Iraq's ruler, Saddam Hussein, who was compared to Adolf Hitler. Testimony was given before Congress of atrocities by Iraqi soldiers against Kuwaiti babies. This testimony has since been proven a deliberate fraud cooked up by the Bush administration and the Kuwaiti government. Bush pressured the United Nations to support a military response, and the ensuing bombardment decimated the Iraqi army in a matter of days. Economic sanctions that have been kept in place for more than a decade against the defeated Iraq have resulted in the deaths of more than 500,000 Iraqi children, many from cancer as a result of the depleted uranium weapons used by the U.S. that litter the landscape. Saddam Hussein had been on the CIA payroll for many years, and his dictatorial regime was kept in power by the U.S. in order to suppress self-determination movements in his own country. He had done this with murderous efficiency, without objection from the U.S. government. Saddam Hussein's crime, from the U.S. government perspective, was to get some independent ideas of his own about who should control and profit from Iraq's oil resources. Throughout the Arab world, many had been asking why U.S.-based multinationals were taking the lion's share of the profit from the oil that lay under their own lands. The U.S. government feared that Hussein's defiance of U.S. power set an example in the Arab world. Most Americans had never heard either of Iraq or Kuwait, and then as now had no real understanding of the nature and goals of the exercise of U.S. military power. Because the targets are generally in themselves repressive governments, the corporate agenda that drives the policy is easy to obfuscate with idealistic rhetoric directed at the average citizen. Among the most ill-informed of Americans are those serving in the armed forces, where the pressure to adopt the government position is almost irresistible. I say almost because from time to time, there are soldiers that gain an understanding of the institution that they're part of, and their conscience compels them to speak out and resist. Tonight we'll hear from two such soldiers, Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine officer who was in charge of the weapons inspection program created as part of the UN-brokered settlement to the 1991 war against Iraq, and Jeff Patterson, a Marine corporal who refused to fight in the Iraq War in 1991.
Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end, for my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers.
G.W. Bush's Axis of Evil State of the Union address made clear his intentions to make war on Iraq. Late last February, the Finger Lakes Greens held a forum in Auburn on the issue of war in Iraq. Former U.S. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter was one of the panelists. Next, we bring you Ritter's presentation and excerpts from his dialogue with the audience.
Scott Ritter served for 8 years as an intelligence officer in the Marine Corps and served as an arms control inspector in the former Soviet Union and as a Scud missile specialist on General Norman Schwarzkopf's staff during the Gulf War before his appointment as a weapons inspector for UNSCOM. As the chief of the concealment investigations team, he oversaw efforts to uncover the true weapons of mass destruction capability of Iraq. He has written about his experiences in Iraq in Endgame, Solving the Iraq Problem, Once and for All, published in 1999 by Simon & Schuster. Ritter currently is working on another manuscript, as well as having completed a documentary film, In Shifting Sands, that exposes the ramifications of the failure of the U.S. policy of economic sanctions-based containment of Iraq. Scott Ritter.
Thank you very much for the kind words of introduction. Apologize, I was running late there. I didn't realize how far Albany is from Auburn. And thanks for the kind recommendation for the book. I certainly hope you check it out of the library or find another way to acquire it. library is fine. But the search for knowledge is extremely important. I think that it's imperative upon all citizens in a functioning democracy, and we need to remind ourselves now and then that we do live in the world's largest functioning democracy. Democracies only function if the citizens become involved, and they only function well if the citizens actually know what they're talking about. So I encourage not only people to go out and read, but to attend discussions and forums such as the one that's taking place here today. I think it's just it's very important that this takes place. I don't believe it's too late. I actually hold hope out that something can be done. What I will say is this. If the current events move forward in 6 months, 8 months, 12 months' time, you'll be wishing we had done something now. We live in a nightmare. It's a nightmare that we're oblivious to as a nation. We live in a nation where we have not only high poll ratings for the President of the United States, but we have likewise similar poll ratings encouraging our country to go to war against Iraq. As we speak, the President of the United States reads these poll figures anywhere from 80 to 85% saying we want to go to war with Iraq. We encourage going to war with Iraq. But before I talk more about the war on Iraq, out of truth and advertising, I need to put out a little bit about myself. I fought in the first war against Iraq. I know what war is. I felt it was a just war. I felt it was a war that needed to be fought. It was a war about the liberation of Kuwait. It wasn't a war about moving on into Baghdad. That was never part of the proposition. I'm not a pacifist. I'm someone who believes that there is a time and a place for wars to be fought. I'll tell you right now that there's no such thing as a good war. War is not good. War is about killing. And for those 80 to 85% of the Americans who say, we want to go to war, they say that out of ignorance. Anybody who has experienced war would never wish that on anybody. War is the worst thing mankind can do to another. I'll be very glad to lead a brigade of politicians, talking heads, and other types who have never experienced combat, never served in the military, but feel it their right to stand in front of the American public and push us on towards war. I'll lead you into combat. Within 5 minutes of the bullets going over your head, they'll be praying for war to stop. I guarantee it. Because once you've experienced it, you never want to have it happen again. And yet, the Americans think it's going to be copacetic, it's going to be easy. Now I'll give you another piece of truth in advertising. I'm a Republican, and I voted for President Bush. So when I sit up here and I talk in a very negative fashion about the policies going forward, I'm not doing this as somebody who has a political agenda. I voted for this man. I believed him when he said we would pursue a foreign policy imbued with humility. And I feel betrayed. Now we're ready to go to war against Iraq. Why? Why are we moving towards a war with Iraq? After people keep talking about September 11th, September 11th, the world changed on September 11th. It'll never be the same after September 11th. That's garbage. September 11th was a bad day. September 11th was a tragedy. September 11th was a crime. September 11th was not an act of war. December 7th was an act of war. December 7th had a Japanese fleet off of Pearl Harbor bombing us. September 7th had German divisions crawling across Europe, threatening Moscow. That was war, ladies and gentlemen. September 11th was a crime, but we treated it like a war. And we went to war, and we are at war in Afghanistan today. So be it. Now, I talked about no such thing as a good war. There isn't. But there are just wars. And while I don't feel that we should be taking on Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, those who perpetrated the horrific events of September 11th, using the tools that we currently are, it is justified. We were attacked. Not by military forces. We were attacked by criminals. Under Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, and I'm a big fan of the UN, as long as they understand their limitations, Article 51 says that a nation has a legitimate right to self-defense. Security Council resolution passed by the Security Council of the United Nations in the aftermath of September 11th found that the United States had the right to invoke Article 51 to hold in account those who perpetrated the assault of September 11th. Plain and simple. Why are we in Afghanistan? Because the Taliban, this regime, provided a safe haven for Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda, the terrorists who committed the crime against America. That's why we're in Afghanistan. Is it good? No. It's not good. We've killed more civilians in Afghanistan than died in the World Trade Center. War's not good. War's about killing. I think people, when they see the Marine Corps training out in 29 Palms, California, see the paper target pop up and the Marine Corps guy shoots it great, they go, wow, that's neat, that's war. They have to understand that in combat, it's not a paper target, it's a human being. And when you shoot it, it falls on the ground and it bleeds. And more often than not, it screams for its mom, its dad. Then they die. That's what war is about. That's what we're doing in Afghanistan. It's not good, but it's just. But notice, after September 11th, what happened in the media. Because it wasn't only the Taliban or Al-Qaeda that was being discussed. It was Iraq. Iraq. You see, after the September 11th attacks, many in the Bush administration said, Osama bin Laden could not have carried out this attack without state sponsorship. It's far too sophisticated, far too complicated, far too difficult for a simple terrorist organization to do. They had to have state sponsorship. And the first nation that came to the forefront was Iraq. Iraq had to be the ones who sponsored this. And conveniently at that point in time, defectors started coming out. Defectors talked about a terrorist training camp south of Baghdad in Salman Pak, where they trained people to take over airplanes, conveniently in groups of four and five, armed with knives. Amazing how this information suddenly came out after September 11th. It's not true. I've been to that terrorist training camp. It's not a terrorist training camp. It's a hostage rescue camp put in place in the 1980s by the British government to support Saddam Hussein, because any nation that has a national airlines has an assault force capable of conducting hostage rescue of aircraft that have been subject to hijacking. We have it. Iraq has it. That's what Salman Pak is, plain and simple. You also have people that talk about, well, wait, an Iraqi intelligence official met with Mohammed Atta, the ringleader of the terrorists in Prague, Czechoslovakia. Isn't that a link? Isn't that a smoking gun? Perhaps. Perhaps. We don't know the truth of what happened. First, the Prime Minister of Czechoslovakia says the meeting took place. Then the President of Czechoslovakia says it didn't take place. Now the Prime Minister says it did take place. Well, what happened? We don't know. But even if we take what they say at face value, what they talked about was the Iraqis seeking to find somebody who would blow up the Radio Free Europe transmission tower. Now, this is a project the Iraqis have been going on for years with. We have evidence in 1998 they tried it, 1999 they tried it, and it should come as no surprise that in 2001 they would try it. Why? Because the United States has funded a group called the Iraqi National Congress, which has as its goal and objectives the overthrow of Saddam Hussein through spreading propaganda, which they broadcast out of the Radio Free Europe Tower in Prague, Czechoslovakia, also through for intelligence collection, and sponsoring groups to go into Iraq and blow up pipelines, put car bombs out in front of Iraqi government buildings, overthrow Saddam through the use of force. The Iraqi National Congress is, ladies and gentlemen, a revolutionary group which has embraced force to overthrow Saddam. Whether I agree with their objectives or not, you have to understand that the Iraqi government views this group as a threat, and therefore views any transmission tower that's broadcasting Iraqi National Congress propaganda as a threat and a legitimate target. Do I condone bombing this tower? No. Is it a link to September 11th? No. None whatsoever. Hence, people have backed down about Muhammad Atta. As we speak, American Marines, soldiers, SEAL commandos, Air Force personnel are in Afghanistan. We've defeated al-Qaeda, at least militarily. We've occupied their camps. We've captured their caves. We've captured computers with hard drives. We've captured documents, thousands of them. And guess what we're finding? In the months since we've captured these, we've arrested over 1,000 al-Qaeda members across the world because these documents give them up. We know who al-Qaeda met with. We know who they plotted with. We know what they were trying to do. And guess what these documents don't show? Any linkage whatsoever with Iraq. See, there is no linkage between al-Qaeda and Iraq. These are two totally separate entities, two totally separate problems. That didn't stop the administration, though, keeping to beat the war drum against Iraq. The next thing that occurred was the anthrax attacks against the United States. You remember the letters went through the Postal Service. Four people died. A dozen others became ill. A tragedy. When these attacks first came forward, all you heard from the media is, look, there's only three nations in the world that can produce this anthrax: the United States, the Soviet Union, and Iraq. And Iraq is the only nation that could have done this. Iraq gave it to the terrorists who are responsible. Well, this flies in the face of logic. You see, anybody who's studied Iraq as long as I have knows that in 1995, although they tried to hold on to it, they declared the totality of their biological warfare programs. In 1996, we blew up the factory that produced anthrax. We know what kind of anthrax the Iraqis produced. We know in what how they produced it, in what quantities they produced it, and we destroyed the production equipment. But even if Iraq had hidden some of this anthrax, it was a different strain, a different kind of anthrax, a different form. It wasn't the dry powder that we saw here. It was ludicrous to immediately jump to the conclusion that Iraq was behind the attack. Anybody who knew anything about biological weapons, and I happen to count myself as one of them, said right up front, if it's AIM strain and it's dry powder form, it's American, plain and simple. We're the only ones who make it. And guess what? It's American. Department of Defense manufactured, and they'll probably be arresting somebody in the near future who has links to American military laboratories. Iraq wasn't involved. Now, but if you turn on the television today, we're going to war against Iraq. We're going to take out Saddam. Well, I just told you there's no link between 9/11. I told you that they weren't behind the anthrax attack. So why are we going after Saddam? What is the reason? We are justified in going to war in Afghanistan because of Article 51 of the United Nations Charter that finds that we're acting in self-defense. How has Iraq attacked us? What is the threat that Iraq poses? You hear a lot of talk about the threat. You'll hear it tonight. Scan the TV channels. Iraq poses a clear and present threat against America. Saddam Hussein threatens our way of life. Threatens our way of life. It's as though if I went off the coast of New York City, there would be the Iraqi fleet ready to bomb us. If I go down to the Mexican border, there's the Iraqi panzer divisions ready to come across the border. Iraq threatens us. Ladies and gentlemen, Iraq threatens nobody but the people of Iraq. Saddam Hussein is not capable of projecting his power outside of his borders. I was part of the effort that destroyed his military. And for over 7 years, I was inside that country uncovering the secrets of their weapons of mass destruction programs. George Bush says, Saddam, let the inspectors back in. Let us get back to the work of finding your weapons. Jerry Hill, Richard Pearl, a very influential person, Paul Wolfowitz and others, get on TV, my former boss, Richard Butler, on television and say, Iraq possesses biological weapons. Not they might possess, we think they're possessed, we're concerned. They possess it, as if they know. They possess chemical weapons. They don't. We destroyed the factories. We destroyed the weapons. You'll hear that we were kicked out. We weren't kicked out. You know why weapons inspectors aren't there today? Because on December 15th, 1998, the deputy ambassador of the United States and the United Nations picked up the phone, called Richard Butler, and said, get your inspectors out of Iraq. Why? Because on December 17th, we started bombing. And what did we do when we bombed? We didn't go after weapons and mass destruction facilities. We went after Saddam Hussein to eliminate the president of Iraq. And now ask yourself, oh, and the other thing is, how did we target Saddam? We used the information collected by the weapons inspectors. So ask yourself, if you're an Iraqi, would you let the inspectors back in? I think not. I think not. But why are we going to war against Iraq? Plain and simple. politics. Saddam's not a threat to anybody but the or anything except the political aspirations and objectives of a neoconservative element in Washington, D.C., who have hijacked the national security of the United States in pursuit of their own ideologically driven personal objectives. The people surrounding George Bush used Saddam Hussein as a foil against Bill Clinton in the 2000 elections. They said, Bill, Congress passed the Iraqi Liberation Act authorizing $100 million to overthrow Saddam. You've only spent $4 million of it. You're not funding it. You're not supporting these rebels. Saddam continues to exist. If we get elected, they said, we'll fully fund it. Not only that, we'll go a step further. We'll use American military power to carve out southern Iraq, create a no-drive zone so Saddam's tanks can't move, and we'll go in and create a safe haven for these rebels to move up and take out Saddam. It'll be a cakewalk, they say. Guess what? They got elected. They tried to fund the Iraqi National Congress, and they found out the reality. These guys are crooks. They're inept. They're incompetent. They don't have a viable constituency inside Iraq. You give them money, it disappears, and they show nothing for it. So how do you fund an opposition that's headed by an embezzler? Ahmed Chalabi. He used to be the head of the Petrobank in Jordan. There's a warrant out for his arrest in Jordan because he embezzled over $1 billion of Jordanian government money. And yet the CIA wants to give this guy $100 million? I think not. The other thing is, no one wants this war. No one supports this war. We talk about democracy and caring for the Iraqis. Democracy in Iraq, a novel concept. 60% of the population is Shia Muslim, the same sect of Islam that is in Iran today, Islamic fundamentalist Iran. We want to give Iraq with the world's second largest proven reserves of oil. We want to give control of that to the Shia? I think not, so let's not talk about democracy. We talk about 23% of the Kurds. We want to help the Kurds? Show me a state in the area that wants an independent Kurdistan or Kurds with significant autonomy. Not us, not the Turks, not the Syrians, not the Iranians, not the Iraqis. Do we want democracy in Iraq? No. We want to turn power over to 17% of the population, the Sunnis. The same Sunnis where Saddam comes from. Now these Sunnis, you think 17%? They're not a homogeneous entity. Watch The Godfather. It's like taking a look at the five families around the table. Italians are all the same, right? They love each other. No, those Italian families fight, feud, murder, conspire until one family emerges dominant. That's how Iraq is ruled. Saddam's family has emerged dominant. 20,000 people in the Abu Nasir clan rule 20 million. That's the reality. You get rid of Saddam and you don't address this, somebody just like Saddam will take over. But getting rid of Saddam, is it going to be a cakewalk? No. We go to war against Iraq, it's going to require hundreds of thousands of American troops. The second we cross the border, the people of Iraq, who for the last decade have watched 1.5 million of their fellow citizens die because of American-backed sanctions, will not rally around this invasion force. The Kurds say that it isn't going to happen. The Shia, who are against Saddam, say don't invade, because the Iraqi people will oppose you. It's not that they support Saddam. They will oppose you, the American invader. Oh, but we'll win. We'll win. We always win. I mean, why is everybody surprised about what happened in Afghanistan? Take the Super Bowl champions and put them on the football field with any high school football team in America. Pick the best one. And I'll tell you what will happen. The high school team won't even score a point. They'll be wiped out. And should we be surprised? When we take the world's largest military power, take it to Afghanistan against a bunch of militia, and we wipe them out, are we surprised? No. Iraq will not be Afghanistan. But we'll win. We'll fight village to village to village, all the way up to Baghdad. And we'll kill hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. You think we're teaching them to love us? You think they're going to like this? So we occupy Baghdad. Let's say we even knock out Saddam. Although we're not very good at hunting down these guys. It's like the where's Waldo effect. Where's Osama? Where's Mullah Omar? We go into Iraq, where's Saddam? It's not that easy. But we'll take Baghdad. How long are we going to occupy Baghdad? What puppet government are we going to put in place? Who's going to embrace it? So before we talk about going to war against Iraq, we better think about it in the long term. War with Iraq is the last thing we can afford to do. Because we may win militarily, but trust me, it'll make Vietnam look like a walk in the park by the time we're done. We'll be hated in the world. We talk about this war on terror. Well, heck, we haven't shown ourselves capable of addressing the symptoms of the war on terror, these 19 men who hijacked an airplane and came after us, yet alone the root causes of the terror. Why do people hate America? You think war against Iraq is going to make people love America? Think again. going to war against Iraq. We may get Saddam. We're going to lose the war on terror. We got to find a way to get the American public to back away from this 85% supporting of going to war and bring it down to realistic figures, hopefully close to zero. Thank you.
I think what you're doing is great. You're letting people, you're trying to get the truth out that this nation is targeting Iraq, and I'm based on complete falsehoods. But you didn't have the guts here today to admit where the source of this targeting is coming from. And Peter Kotzer mentioned it, but this is all being targeted. This is all being orchestrated by three parties: Israel, the Jewish lobby in America, and the Jewish-controlled media, which is filling this country with total falsehoods. Answer that.
A couple things. One, it's not very often that a Marine Corps officer lets somebody get away with calling them a coward, so use that word judiciously. Two, I'll be more than happy to answer it if it's phrased as a request and not a demand. Number three is the guy who headed intelligence cooperation between the United Nations and the State of Israel from 1994 to 1998, I will say the following. When I went there in 1994, the Director of Military Intelligence stated that Iraq was Israel's number one threat. When I left in 1998, Iraq was the number six threat faced by the State of Israel and falling. The reason why Israel had a change of heart in terms of the threat represented by Iraq was because of the close cooperation between the United Nations and Israeli intelligence, which enabled us to investigate fully and thoroughly every piece of information Israel was concerned about inside Iraq. And we did so to the satisfaction of the Israeli government. You may not be aware of this, but the last couple weeks, the Israelis have sent delegations to Washington, D.C., encouraging George Bush not to make a move on Iraq. That to make a move on Iraq right now is unnecessary, and unwise for the security of Israel. See, they view the threats as being elsewhere. So when you put forward your trilogy, your troika, your evil axis of people that have conspired to take on Saddam Hussein, I would say you're wrong. I share your frustration with the influence that certain pro-Israeli lobbies have in Washington, D.C. I'm concerned about this. But I would also say that in my speaking around the country, I've spoken at a number of Jewish synagogues in the United States which share the same concerns about the move on Iraq as their Catholic, Protestant, and other denominational brethren. So I would hesitate to put forward such a blanket accusation that it's Israel, pro-Israeli lobbies, and American Jews that are behind this. No, I'd say again, let's keep it more political. It's Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, John Bolton, and others surrounding George Bush who have, in the last 5 or 6 years, made it their personal, ideologically driven vendetta to remove Saddam Hussein, regardless of the facts. That's where I'd focus my efforts on.
Hi. I'd like to make a question that's based on one of my hobbies lately has been sort of looking at the news from the rest of the world. What you read in newspapers, what you hear on TV, often is very, very different from what you hear what you see when you look at the web. Two little issues, and forgive me for reading this, but it's fairly short. One is from, they're both from ArabicNews.com. It's a very easy website to get to, ArabicNews.com. This says the British tabloid The Sun, issued on Monday, said that the U.S. is intending to found a central leadership base in Bahrain in order to supervise the land war to be carried out by some 200,000 U.S. soldiers from Kuwait under the cover of intensive air bombardment operations against Iraq from Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, as well as planes and the carriers in the Gulf. The paper indicated that the countdown has started to carry out the strikes against Iraq in May. Second, also from ArabicNews.com, and I don't know if this is true, if this is false, but it's in the news in the Middle East, and so we at least have access to what they are hearing as news. The Kuwaiti daily Al Sayasa, issued on Wednesday, received information which stated that the U.S. administration has prepared the Iraqi retired Major General Najib al-Salehi for the presidency of an Iraqi provisional government. They've already got the guy chosen out to play the role of Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan. Now, I'm wondering, well, how far along this path have we already marched? I don't know whether it's even possible to put the brakes on, what we should do at this point, and also I don't know how much credence to give these.
Look, I still maintain sources of information. I would say that much of what you've put forward there reflects maybe not an immediate reality, a pressing reality, but an intent. And it's an intent that's taking place in the background. It's an intent that's not going through the democratic process, which requires Congress to be kept appraised, Congress to undertake certain actions that give the president the authority to take our fellow citizens who wear the uniform in the armed services and engage in combat. I would say that it's not nearly as pressing right now. My understanding of the debate is that the military leaders say we can't even begin to move on Baghdad without 200,000 troops. The planners around George Bush don't want to commit anything more than 75,000. And so they're trying to create a fiction in terms of Iraqi people support, putting together certain coalitions that may or may not come to being to support the lower figure. I think May is a very ambitious date, definitely for 200,000 troops. It takes a lot to push that much logistics equipment forward. But the bottom line, though, is the point that was raised. When you have it, this has gone well beyond contingency planning. I've been involved in contingency planning my entire life. This is really carrying out a preparations for war covertly. Now, that's one thing to do it when you're already engaged in war. I understand D-Day. You don't want to telegraph your invasion of Normandy to the Germans, but we're already at war. They are moving forward in Washington, D.C., as if Congress has already provided the approval to engage in conflict. And it hasn't. And I don't think Congress will. I think Congress has failed in its job not only to the president, to protect the president, but to us, the people of the United States, to whom they're responsible. And frankly speaking, we failed. Because we're not holding these guys accountable for their lack of action. This is a failure across the board. And as I said, when you have so many failures taking place, it's very easy for a handful of neoconservative elements to hijack the national security agenda of the United States. And that's what's taking place.
I have two questions, actually. One is that I read fairly recently in the New Yorker magazine that the area in northern Iraq where the food for oil is being distributed by the UN and the money and the food is going directly to the Kurdish people is now an economically stable part of the country, and that there is, in fact, enough money going into Iraq that if Saddam Hussein were not diverting it, the people of Iraq would have enough medicine, water, food, and clothing. And I have a second question as well, and that is that when I first became familiar with your name through the New Yorker article a couple of years ago, and I can't remember who wrote it, I got the impression from that article that at the time that you left Iraq, there were still some possibility that there were serious weapons of mass destruction still in the country, that Saddam had been good enough at moving things around so that you hadn't gotten everything. And you kind of gave a different impression today, so I wondered also if you'd like to comment on that. And I just really want to thank you for coming here today. I thought it was absolutely great to hear you talking here. Thank you.
Well, I'll answer the first one, or the second question first. Beware the journalist. I Peter Boyer was the gentleman who wrote the article for the New Yorker magazine. I spent over 80 hours, and I'll say it again for people to understand, 80 hours, that's 80 hours with Peter Boyer to give him the background information to write that article. And what he produced, frankly speaking, was utter crap. And every journalist I've dealt with since then has done the same thing, which is why I've taken the time to write a book and to make a movie. So what I would suggest is if you want to understand what my position is on things, don't read the words of others. Read my words, see the movie I made, and hold me accountable for those words. But I refuse to be held accountable for the words of journalists because, frankly speaking, they haven't gotten it right, and I've lost all faith in the journalists to get it right in the future. Now, on the second issue on Iraq, on the humanitarian situation, I will caveat this by saying that I'm not the right person to be answering this. I was a weapons inspector. The right person to be answering this is Dennis Halliday, Hans von Sponeck, and the others who are intimately familiar with what's taking place in northern Iraq and the rest of Iraq in regards to oil for food. But I'll throw out two points. One of the reasons why the situation in Kurdistan is different from the situation in Iraq is that they receive cash, and they're able to take that cash and do with it as they see fit. The Iraqi government does not receive cash from the United Nations. To judge what's happening in Kurdistan and compare and contrast that with what's happening in the rest of Iraq is like comparing apples to oranges. It just doesn't work. Two, last year Iraq sold about $11 to $12 billion worth of oil. Of that oil, under oil for food, of that oil, a significant amount is skimmed off the top for reparations. Another certain percentage goes to the United Nations to pay for what's turned into an increasingly expensive program in Iraq to implement oil for food. Of what remains, which is about $7.5 billion, the United States has put economic holds on $5.5 billion of that. All right? So let's keep that in mind when we evaluate what's going on inside Iraq. Saddam Hussein's not stopping the people of Iraq from getting clothes, shoes, food, etc. He may be cynically manipulating the oil for food sanctions in some ways to increase the suffering of the Iraqi people for his own political gain. Of course he is. Saddam Hussein, I have nothing nice to say. I'll throw, again, another truth in advertising, one of these things I like to put out there so you know where I'm coming from. Because, again, you read some of these journalists, they'll call me a friend of Saddam. They'll say that I'm Saddam's American apologist. Saddam tried to assassinate me 3 times. I had Saddam Hussein's bodyguard with a pistol to my head threatening to decorate a wall with my brains. You think I like this guy? I hate him. I hate the ground he stands on. I hate what he represents. But I'm able to step back from this and apply professionalism. And when you judge Iraq without the passions that hatred bring in, what you'll understand is, yes, there is cynical manipulation of the oil for food agreement by Saddam Hussein to increase the suffering of the Iraqi people, and he does that for his own political good. He's been able to convince the Iraqi people that what's happening to them is not his fault, but the fault of Americans and the United Nations and the economic sanctions. And the people have rallied around Saddam Hussein in a way they never have before. Because of sanctions, Saddam Hussein is a more secure leader in Iraq than he has been at any time since 1991. But what I'll also say is this. When you have economic sanctions that have resulted in the death of 1.5 million people, you can sit here and say that Saddam Hussein is to blame. I'll call him the trigger man for you, okay? We'll indict him as the trigger man. We'll say, Saddam, you're the trigger man. You pulled the trigger on 1.5 million dead Iraqis because of economic sanctions. You have the key to solve this all. You cooperate with the inspectors. Sanctions will be lifted. The food would come in. The people of Iraq would flourish. Okay, so Saddam's guilty. Let's find him guilty. Let's condemn him right now. But let's do something else, too. Since 1991, the United States has had a policy in place that says we don't care if Saddam gives up his weapons of mass destruction. Keep in mind, sanctions are lifted when there's a finding of compliance. These aren't sanctions forever. They're lifted when Iraq complies with its disarmament obligation. Sanctions, according to the United States, will stay in place until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power, regardless of his obligation to disarm. So the United States has no intention of allowing these sanctions to be lifted. In 1997, Madeleine Albright, when confronted with the number of Iraqi dead, dead Iraqi children, said, "That's a price we're willing to pay." All right? So Saddam's a trigger man. You know what we are? We're the getaway driver. And in a court of law, we're both guilty of murder. And I'd like to hold the United States to a slightly different moral standard than I would Saddam Hussein. We shouldn't be involved in this process. This is a process that is going nowhere. We've corrupted the process. We're using the process for the means which were not originally intended by international law, by the Security Council. But if you want the details of the tragedy that's unfolding in Iraq, don't turn to me. I'm just a weapons inspector. Turn to Dennis Halliday, turn to Han von Sponeck. They'll give you the truth.
Thank you.
I have two things. I wonder if you could tell us how to obtain the films on video, because it seems to me that that might be a very good thing. I don't know what's in it, but having heard you speak today, to be distributed and watched in the coming months as the war drum is beating. And I would be interested to hear if Mr. Harris seemed to be speaking of the "we better go get him" with regard to Saddam. And I wonder if you two could engage in a little dialogue on that. You spoke before, Mr. Ritter, and haven't spoken since. I'd like to hear you exchange views on that.
Yeah. Let me pose a philosophical question to you. I don't know how extensive your knowledge of history is, but back in the 30s, there was a region of France called Alsace-Lorraine, and the Germans made a lot of noise and they grabbed that. Now, hindsight is great, but now we look back at that. If we had stopped them when they tried to make that grab, World War II could have been avoided. Now, I'm definitely talking in theory now, but anytime anyone tries to attribute common sense and logic to Saddam Hussein, they lose. You take whatever the situation is, figure what a common, normal person would do, and do just the opposite, and then you have an idea of how Saddam Hussein thinks. Now, I have no doubt, after what I've seen throughout the years of Iraq and Saddam Hussein, that he could very easily lob a nuke into Tel Aviv. He doesn't need weapons of mass destruction as far as armies are concerned. All it's going to take is one. So I'll pose the question to you. If we had gone in and stopped some dictators in the 30s for the ultimate good of avoiding carnage, why can't we apply that same logic to Saddam Hussein with what we know of him now? Now, when I say go in and get him, I'm not for going in there and carpet bombing. Well, we've done that before. And the stories of the people that are getting killed by the thousands there is heartbreaking, because I think it was wrong at Dresden, and I think it's wrong in Baghdad. But the question is, from what we know, how do you stop a madman, and when do you stop him for the ultimate good in the future?
One, I'll leave two copies of the movie with the organizers here, and they can make it available to whoever would like to see it. I'll leave that up to the organizers to do that. Two, if we had gone into Europe and when Hitler made his grab on Alsace-Lorraine, and we slapped him back and maybe defeated the German army when it was weak and stuff, we wouldn't have gone on to Berlin. We wouldn't have removed Adolf Hitler. We would have just prevented we would have rolled him back out of Alsace-Lorraine. What we did in Kuwait in 1991. Saddam made a move with the world's fourth largest army in 1991. Months later, that fourth largest army was defeated on the field of battle. Saddam was destroyed, his military evicted. We stood up. We stood up to a dictator. We didn't go on to Baghdad, just the same way that no one would have gone on to Berlin in the 1930s when they seized Alsace-Lorraine, or even if we had stood up to him when he moved into Czechoslovakia. That's the reality of life. And I'll say this about weapons of mass destruction. You don't make them in a basement. You don't make them in underground caves. You're a physicist, you know this. Nuclear weapons are produced in massive facilities, gigantic facilities that require many billions, tens of billions of dollars of investment, access to the highest levels of technology, access to highly enriched uranium. There's a lot of concern about there might be some highly enriched uranium out there on the market. Well, guess what? If it was, somebody'd have it. You know, that's been a problem that's been around since the fall of the Soviet Union. And where are all the suitcase bombs? They're not there. We should be concerned about it, But we definitely shouldn't live in fear as though someone somehow is going to fire one into Tel Aviv overnight. No, a nuclear bomb is the byproduct of a nuclear weapons program. We destroyed Iraq's nuclear weapon program. I destroyed Iraq's nuclear weapons program. I'll sit here and tell you right now, I've been inside every one of their facilities. I've interviewed every one of their nuclear scientists. It ain't there. Now, missiles. I happen to know a little bit about ballistic missiles. The same thing. Even if Iraq possessed the long-range missiles that they had during the Gulf War, the ones that they launched against Israel, take a look at the pathetic payload that these missiles had. You know, we're talking a couple hundred kilograms. The nuclear weapon that Iraq was designing was 1.2 tons. They didn't have a missile capable of delivering this. Even if they had shrunk the missile down to the proper diameter, they didn't have a missile capable of delivering this. It would have taken Iraq 5 to 8 years of continuing to develop their program unhindered by weapons inspectors before they could come up with a delivery system capable of bringing a nuclear weapon, a nuclear device, to Tel Aviv. But they don't have a missile program worthy of the name. We destroyed it. They're allowed under Security Council resolution to produce a missile with a range less than 150 kilometers, and they have such a missile. It's called the Al Samud. I've watched the Al Samud grow up since it was a little baby in 1994, and I'm telling you right now, in 1998, the last couple times the Iraqis launched it, didn't work. The missile would fizzle on the test stand. When it did launch, we didn't know which way it was going to go. Sometimes it blew up in the air. It won't work. You know why we know it won't work? It's not that we just watch it when it's launched. We were there in the factory. We watched them design it. We watched them mill the parts. We watched them assemble it. We watched them do everything to that. Why? We were weapons inspectors. That was our job. That's the kind of intimacy we had of not only the Iraqi missile program, but everything in Iraq. So when we sit here and tell you, when I sit here and tell you that they don't have it, it's not guesswork. It's not as though we're speculating. We know. Why? We were there. And we weren't there just being blocked by the Iraqis. Whenever the Iraqis blocked me and other inspectors from a site, these were sites that dealt with Saddam Hussein's personal security, not Saddam Hussein's weapons programs. These are sites that dealt with Saddam's bodyguards, with Iraqi intelligence, with Iraqi signal intelligence. Why? Because we thought they might be hiding documents. Not weapons, documents. But when we went to the factories that were capable of being converted to produce weapons of mass destruction, we were never once blocked. And since 1994, we monitored these factories. Not only did we find that they didn't have the capability and that they weren't producing weapons of mass destruction, that it would take them 5 to 6 years with full access to technology, with full access to money that's denied to them by economic sanctions, to begin to reconstitute to a level that they could be of concern to us. So I would say that rather than being worried about this hypothetical Iraqi nuclear weapon that's going to fall down on Tel Aviv, let's get the weapons inspectors back in Iraq. So there's no guesswork. We take the guesswork out of it. We get the inspectors back in, they inspect the Iraqi industrial capability, and they ensure Iraq doesn't reconstitute, and we avoid a needless war. I'll just throw in one comment. This is my personal observation. As I said at the beginning, I'm sort of a conservative Republican, and I'm not one. I've never participated in peace activism and anti-war movements, et cetera. And I have nothing but the highest respect for voices in the wilderness. But, you know, I'm a military man, and I'm somebody who likes to win. You know, when I get involved in something, I want to achieve victory. In this case, I've chosen to get involved in trying to stop a war with Iraq. What I see is a needless war. You know, the world deals with law. And the law right now is Security Council resolution that defines weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It's very specific, Section C of Resolution 687, is chemical, biological, nuclear weapons, and ballistic missiles with a range greater than 150 kilometers. We're getting ready to go to war against Iraq using these as the justification for it. I would suggest that the best thing we could do for the people of Iraq to get the sanctions lifted so they can move forward is stay focused on that. Because to do otherwise, to try and bring some sort of moral equivalency between Saddam and the United States, you know, we've got to find a way to get this 80 to 85% of the American public who thinks war against Iraq is a good thing to change their mind. And we're not going to do that by trying to bring some sort of moral equivalency between Saddam and the United States by saying, well, we do weapons of mass destruction too. Focus on the law. Focus on the specifics, and that's where I think we're going to make the points that will get the American Legion, the Veterans of Foreign War, United Auto Workers, and others who are currently wrapping themselves in the American flag, thumping their chests and saying, let's move forward because it's patriotism, to maybe understand that patriotism involves a little bit more than that, that it might involve turning on the brain, thinking, absorbing facts, judging, becoming knowledgeable, and then holding elected representatives accountable for actions that maybe we shouldn't be involved in. But again, not too critical, because I've been doing a lot of work with Voices in the Wilderness, and I salute their goals and objectives. But I frankly think that if we take this tack of trying to stray away from the specifics of the law that we're dealing with, that is UN Security Council resolutions, and bring in these other issues, that we'll be sitting here this time next year going, gosh, you know, we're at war with Iraq, because we're not going to change anything. The only way to stop this war is to broaden the coalition. And the only way you're going to broaden the coalition is to focus in on those salient points that have true meaning. And right now, true meaning is defined, frankly speaking, as international law as set forth by the Security Council. If the United States, and this is a point I'd like to make, if the United States moves against Iraq unilaterally, as we appear to be doing, we'll be joining a list of nations that includes North Korea when they invaded South Korea in 1950, and Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait in 1990. Ask yourself, is that the company you want to be keeping? My wife's from the former Soviet Union, you know, so while sometimes she may think I'm evil, I definitely don't view her as evil. I was a weapons inspector in the former Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War. Went over to the Soviet Union in 1988 as a hard charge of Marine Corps lieutenant, trained to hate commies, take on the evil empire. And I got into a place called Votkinsk, 700 kilometers due west of Moscow, in the foothills of the Ural Mountains, where they make the SS-25 intercontinental ballistic missile. Very modern missile. It's called a city killer. It basically fires that single warhead that comes in and takes out an American city. Which I think this would, you know, here's a place in the evil empire that produces the evil arrows that will be fired by the evildoers against America to wipe us out, as they are wont to do. But the reality of what I saw on the ground was so much different. I think it's absolutely necessary for us to understand both sides of the story. I think the records show that the kind of government that the Soviet Union had was an evil government. It's an evil form of government. It's a government that can systematically murder not millions, tens of millions of its own citizens. And they could do it with the snap of a finger. But we need to humanize this a little bit, because the people I saw in Votkinsk weren't evil. They were human beings just like us, who suffered under their government, who lived life and enjoyed life the way that we live life and we enjoy life. So we need to be careful about these labels. When we label Saddam Hussein as the Middle East equivalent of Adolf Hitler, we're doing a tremendous disservice to 20 million Iraqis who aren't Saddam Hussein and only want to live their lives the way we want to live our lives. And I learned this as a weapons inspector in Iraq. Believe me, I know more about the Iraqi government than just about anybody. I've studied them from top to bottom. I've been in Saddam's bedroom, bathroom, living room, and seat of government, and I've inspected his documents, and I know how they think. And they're no better than the Soviet Union. This is a government that can, at the snap of a finger, condemn entire tribes to death. But the people of Iraq aren't evil. So we have to be cautious about these labels that we apply, because I think it's an oversimplification of the problem. And the other thing I would say is, if you read the transcripts of the Politburo meetings, and we have these transcripts, these aren't evil plotters sitting around. These are incompetent people trapped by a system that forced them to seek some extreme solutions. But this isn't as though you have extremely competent evildoers sitting around plotting. The reason why the Soviet Union fell is because they were incompetent, plain and simple. You have to be careful about this. If you read the minutes of the Ba'ath Party meetings, as I have, these are some very clever people, very clever, very well-educated people. Saddam Hussein isn't somebody who lives his life doing the opposite of what Western logic dictates. Saddam Hussein does what is required to continue the survival of Saddam Hussein. And the fact that this man came in power in 1968 and he's still there today and he's outlasted several American presidents, shows that he's succeeding. He's not stupid. He's not ignorant. He's a very clever man, a very diabolical man, but he's also just one man. There's 20 million Iraqis that live in that country. So we have to be careful with these labels. I would hesitate with, you know, with these blanket labels, because if you oversimplify the problem, you're going to oversimplify the solution. And then that leads to a whole bunch of a whole host of issues.
In the last forum, I had asked about the World Court and the fact that the United States was the only member that had not joined. And listening to you today, I'm sure there is a subtle reason, very obvious actually, why they haven't joined the World Court. And the second thing, because it's voters that elect folks to Congress, the reason probably they haven't done their job is because 85% of Americans are supporting what President Bush is saying. So that may have something to do with it. Thank you.
I'll answer the second part first. This administration is not interested in getting weapons inspectors back into Iraq whatsoever, because getting weapons inspectors back into Iraq implies that we would respect the system that these weapons inspectors symbolize. That is Security Council Resolution 687 that calls for the disarmament of Iraq and the lifting of economic sanctions without any additional riders, such as the elimination of Saddam Hussein. This government's focus, and it has been the focus of every government since 1991, Republican and Democrat alike, is the isolation and containment of Saddam Hussein until which time he can be removed from power. Right now, in the post-September 11th atmosphere, the Bush administration feels that it can ride on the coattails of 80 to 85% support ratings to engage Iraq decisively to remove Saddam Hussein from power. They're trying to find, I think, the fuel to feed this passion, the cause around which not only the people of America, but the world would rally behind. They tried unsuccessfully to link Saddam with Al-Qaeda. They tried to link Saddam with the anthrax attacks. Right now, they're talking about getting weapons inspectors back in. There's a very easy way to get inspectors back in, and that's to say that once Iraq's disarmed, sanctions will be lifted. You do this, and the Iraqis will come to play. I guarantee it. They've said it over and over again. But since 1991, the United States has said, it doesn't matter. Sanctions will stay in place. That's unacceptable. Now, the Iraqis have been disarmed to a fundamental level. 90 to 95% level of disarmament has been achieved. This is fact. It's without dispute. The United Nations documentation backs this up. Every executive chairman, from Rolf Acacius to Richard Butler, acknowledges this. It's not as though I'm fabricating this number. It's real. The question is what to do about the remaining 5 to 10%. Under the old resolution, which required 100% disarmament, we had to go after that 5 to 10%. Iraq could not be found in compliance without that 5 to 10%. And we did go after it. That meant trying to find documentation that would enable us to figure out what happened to this stuff, documentation that might have been protected by organs close to the president of Iraq, which meant that we had to inspect presidential areas, security sites, intelligence facilities, places that don't have anything to do with weapons of mass destruction other than the fact that somebody might have a document hidden in his desk. That's why we went there. If you want to get weapons inspectors back into Iraq, I suggest we step away and talk about what is the objective of the Security Council of the United Nations when they passed Resolution 687. Was it 100% disarmament to the letter of the law? No. It was getting rid of those weapons programs which they felt, as long as they are continue to be in the possession of Saddam Hussein, represent a clear and present risk to international peace and security. These programs are gone. They've been gone since 1995, 1996. You want to get weapons inspectors back in Iraq, find Iraq to be fundamentally disarmed under Resolution 687. Therefore, lift the economic sanctions, but follow through with the rest of the resolution. See, there's two more resolutions on the book. 715, which is ongoing monitoring and verification, passed in 1993, implemented in 1994. This calls for weapons inspectors to go into every industrial facility, indeed any facility they want to in Iraq, no notice inspections, and monitor these facilities to ensure that Iraq doesn't reconstitute capability. Resolution 1051, passed in 1996, implemented since that time, the export-import control regime, which requires Iraq to declare there's a thick list of dual-use materials, that is, machines that can be used not only for legitimate civilian goods, but could be converted for prohibited uses. These machines have to be declared to the United Nations. Any time Iraq seeks to buy these machines, they have to declare it, not just Iraq, but the nation that sells it. And then the inspectors follow, track this material as it comes into Iraq and into the facilities, tag it, and it can't be moved. We monitor how it's used. No secret. That's what we did. It worked. The beauty of it is not only did Iraq accept this, and implement it. But the Security Council accepted this. If you take a look at 715 and 1051, the annexes that exist on both these resolutions, they are more stringent than what is being put forward by Colin Powell in these so-called smart sanctions. You know, we keep saying, well, the smart sanctions will put out this new list that controls what Iraq can bring in, can't bring in. Why come up with smart sanctions? We have two resolutions in place, which Iraq has agreed to, which have been implemented with the, by the inspectors with no problems, that are more strict, more stringent than smart sanctions. The difference is, under the original law, those resolutions apply once sanctions have been lifted, once control of the Iraqi economy has been turned over to the government of Iraq. In the Colin Powell place, the control of the economy will never be turned over to Iraq, ever. That this list will be implemented with the monies going into a foreign-held bank account, the Iraqis have to beg the world to be allowed to buy what they need to work with. We can get weapons inspectors in today that will do the job of disarming Iraq. But understand that the Bush administration doesn't want Iraq disarmed. They want Saddam gone. And they will use the concept, the fears of an Iraqi weapons of mass destruction program to whip up the drums of war, to whip up war fervor. And this will work, unfortunately, because people don't want to read the small print. People will accept at face value Richard Pearl when he gets on TV station and says that America knows Saddam has biological weapons. Well, excuse me, April 2001, CIA report. CIA report says we have no proof, no evidence that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction or is producing it. We are concerned that they might be able to do so, but we have no evidence. The fact is we don't know, and we won't know until we get weapons inspectors back in. But I also make this prediction to you. You can hold me accountable to it. If you remember prior to our defeat of the Taliban, et cetera, Al-Qaeda had weapons of mass destruction programs. Remember that? Osama bin Laden was trying to buy a nuke. He's trying to make biological weapons. He's trying to make chemical weapons. Oh, and death was going to rain from the skies. Well, what happened when we occupied Afghanistan? Not a single weapon of mass destruction was found. They found a lot of high school type journals that terrorists downloaded from the internet. You know, but that makes just about every high school student in America a potential proliferator of weapons of mass destruction. The fact of the matter is, Al-Qaeda didn't possess this capability. And we know that now that we occupy. If we go into Iraq, and I think we're going to, I think it's too late really to stop it. I don't think the American public cares enough. They won't care until the body bags come home, and they will come home. But by then it's too late. When we go into Iraq and we occupy Iraq and we get full access to the archives, I'll make a prediction right now. They'll find that Iraq was fundamentally disarmed in 1995, and since 1995, Iraq has undertaken no meaningful efforts to reconstitute their weapons of mass destruction programs. This is the truth. This is the facts. This is known to the U.S. government right now. But if you embrace the facts, you can't embrace the justification, the causability, the reason why we want to go to war. We don't want weapons inspectors in Iraq. We want to use the concept of getting weapons inspectors back into Iraq as justification for going to war.